56. What a mix of emotion.
I for a second couldn't remember what we talked about. This is the intro. I mean, we haven't talked about it yet. Today, we are going to talk I'm going to talk about all the people being detained in Israel by the Shin Bet and interrogated.
Yeah, and I'm going to talk about Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was the second official president of Egypt. But really, he was the first, and what trend he set for military dictatorships after his rule. And we're also going to call my mama.
I'm going to talk to Shireen's mama about some interesting stuff.
It's a good long episode. Please stick around. You won't regret it.
Who are we? Where did we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
We're back. Episode 56. What rhymes with six?
Sex.
No. Get into the mix. Don't eat tricks. A lot of sugar.
There you go. You hit all the top ones. It's 4:20 p.m.
Oh my god.
The joints are lit. The blunts are lit. Are put out.
We're inhaling nothing.
We never inhaled.
We?
Who's that? Was that Clinton or was that? No, that was Obama.
That was Obama.
Because Clinton inhaled after he put it in a pussy.
What?
That's a Monica Lewinsky.
But you're talking about Obama.
Yeah, no, I'm saying Obama said he didn't inhale, maybe he did inhale, and Clinton didn't inhale.
Yeah, Obama was more like degaff.
Obama's like, why do I have to make a comment on this? That's right, Clinton didn't inhale, but he did put his cigars in Monica Lewinsky's vagina.
Cigar meaning penis. Or you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about his actual.
He did that?
Yeah, what? That was like one of the things that came out that he.
Are you joking? Why did I not know this?
I don't. It's not.
I'm so
I
disturbed.
Don't know. We don't like talk about it. Like
her
every
vagina's
day.
Dirty as fuck now, ashy.
No, I don't think he'd lit it yet. Oh, you? No. He doesn't put a lit cigar in her vagina. That would.
Why did I not know about
next
this?
Level? Oh, yo.
I know about the dress. I know about the lipstick or whatever the shit. But fucking cigar.
Wait, what was the lipstick?
There was like lipstick on something, right?
His lapel.
I don't know what it was. I don't know. Maybe I made the part up. Maybe it was just like my cinematic
What's the
brain.
Dress?
Wasn't there like a dress that she wore that like has semen's on it or whatever?
Wow.
Yeah. But the cigar.
When you said semen, I thought of electrical, like the brand, the technology company, not actual
There's
semen.
An electric company named Siemens.
Siemon.
That's just unfortunate.
Yeah, semen, right? Okay. Well, come on. Semen. No, I think you mean cum. Yeah.
Also, the person that we're saying right to today is...
New intern.
You might know him from Daily Zeitgeist, Jack O'Brien.
Yes, he's our intern. That's right. Yeah. Look, guys, you can't hold power for that long. You will fall from grace.
You gotta like, give a handout to the white man, you know? Every
you
once in a while.
Help them out.
Yeah, but he's sitting in, and he's the best.
And, like, don't think he won't get fired after this.
Yeah, he's been a very shitty intern. He barely offered me water. Like,
yeah. I'm so sorry about that. I apologize.
I know. I have to talk to you. Like, it's a private meeting later. Performance evaluation.
Yeah, Jack, we're going to have to meet after this. It's not looking good. Okay, yeah. No, he did put it. He apparently, according to
her...
I don't actually remember who it was according
well,
to.
Well, it was either
somehow
him or her.
It came
like,
out.
Two of them were there.
You know it wasn't him.
Exactly. That's why he says her.
I don't think he's out here being like, let me tell you about what me and Monica got.
I wonder if Hillary like refused to do that with him and then he was like, finally my chance.
That is like a really weirdly fetish thing. Like where you're like, you know what I've always wanted to do?
And then he like pulls out a cigar. She's like, what? Like out of his pocket that he's always had. The same cigar.
In his pocket for like 10 years. She's like, finally, Hillary has no interest
like,
in this
how
unsanitary.
Old is this? This is the driest cigar. Anyway.
What do you think Hillary said when he tried to offer the, maybe
like we, like talk her into doing that? I don't know. Maybe like.
Maybe she didn't even acknowledge it.
Maybe like, maybe he made an innuendo like, it's smaller than my dick, so it won't hurt as bad.
I like the concept that he's like, my dick is huge.
Yeah. So you... Well, I'm so sorry. We're calling my mom in this episode. She's probably going to listen to this whole thing. I just realized that
this intro is so
dirty. My mom hates when I talk... What's the word? In Arabic, it's called, like, nazinit. And in English, I guess the translation is, like...
Just vulgar?
Vulgar, yeah. Yeah. But, yeah.
That's interesting.
She hates it. I'm like that. But I'm always like
most
that.
Mothers don't like vulgarities.
That's true.
My mom just ignores it.
Yeah, she ignores a lot, your mom.
Yeah, my mom ignores a lot.
That's her advice for us all. Just ignore them.
You should see how it breaks down in therapy. Not well.
Oh.
But, yeah. Yeah, he put... Anyway, so let's just finish this conversation. He puts the cigar in her pussy, and then he smokes it. That's the theory.
Which end goes in her pussy?
Oh, boy. And you're concerned your mother's
going to
hear
this. I'm sorry. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
All right. You know what? I'll draw it out.
No. I truly don't know. I feel so weird that I had no idea about this part of the Lewinsky shit. I'm just going to go think about it forever now.
You know, I feel like I didn't know about it until I was at UC Davis for college.
I was there, too.
Oh, you're that was a really stupid moment. Maybe you've heard of it.
You see the one with the cows?
Yeah, it's like an ag school.
Yeah.
He came and spoke. Do you remember that?
I remember that. And
I think it was like freshman year.
I wasn't able to go. I was bummed because I really like him.
It was crazy. Like everyone tried to get in and there was like, it was overpacked. And then we just at the last minute rushed the building and got in.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't even make it in.
But I don't think I knew that at that point. And then I think I have a memory of someone leaning over to me and be like, you know what he did to Monica Lewinsky, right? And I was like, what? Yeah, that's...
What if that was me? And I have no memory of it.
Wait, yeah, must have been freshman year because it was when she was going against Obama.
Yeah, that was a freshman year.
So early freshman year.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That was like September probably.
Yeah, way early.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, okay, that makes more sense. Because I was like, why would he just be randomly speaking? But he was going around doing stuff for her, clearly.
Yeah.
Because of that the cigar.
It's like, you owe me, Bill.
This
go do the college tour.
We did not plan to have this conversation.
But I like it. I don't mind it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. I want to tell you about a book I just got that you might find interesting.
Please tell me about it.
Marie Kondo's... The life-changing magic of tidying up.
I'm throwing my life away, I've decided.
No, I don't know. I've read like one chapter. I don't mean like I'm throwing my life away, like I'm throwing my life away. I mean like I'm gonna throw a bunch of things
I knew what you meant because I know that book. And I am a pack rat and I have a very hard time throwing things away because I'm like, what if I need it? What if the sentimental memory I have?
I'm gonna be honest with you, I'm skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
Because like when I did purchase it, everyone around me, like every person around me for somehow had read it.
Mm-hmm.
And every single person claimed it changed their life.
Yeah. That's what happens. Everyone says that about that book.
Yeah.
So I'm like, am I weak too?
I don't know. I'm on chapter one. Well, a car alarm has gone off to warn me that my life's about to change.
Does not bode well.
I just don't
know. You
gotta
let me know if you're gonna change as a person entirely.
Well, I think you'll know, right? I'll come in, I'll be like...
Just naked?
Fucking crazy. I'll be naked.
Just the same
clothes.
Nothing
brought me joy.
Yeah, the same clothes every day.
That's what I did worry. I was like, fuck, what if I lose everything? Because I'm like, nothing gives me joy.
And they just go home to an empty apartment.
Yeah.
No car, no nothing.
Or
trim?
I've packed everything away.
Yeah, that's sad.
I'm like, where are the kids?
Let's not go there. Where are the kids?
In the box. Bring me joy, so I donated that.
Yeah, let me know how that goes. I need to very much work on my inability to throw things out.
Well, you can borrow the book when I'm done.
Yeah, please.
Sounds like you need that book.
I think I'm just in denial.
I'm more just concerned about I have a lot of clothes.
Yeah, same. I mean, I'm organized. My place is organized. I like organizing, but when it comes to old sentimental things, I'm like, what if I need this one day? Or like,
yeah, that's a problem.
And especially because I'm a filmmaker, I'm like, a prop, even though it's not true. Like, I'll never use like an old whatever as a, like a guitar that I've never played in like 10 years as a prop. I don't know. This is my room.
Huh.
But who knows?
I can hang that up.
Yeah.
Okay, well, what do you want to talk about today?
Well, today, I got this idea from my lovely mother, and because I saw her this weekend, and...
You guys watched Mamma Mia together?
No, I did not. My mom wants to see it very badly, but my dad hates musicals, so he won't see it with her.
Sam?
He's Sam's. Celine.
And where do you think that stems from?
I don't know. I think he just likes action movies.
Oh.
Very man. But today I want to talk about how this military dictator in the Middle East was kind of created. I mean, it started with the first person of his kind, Gamal Abdel Nasser. He was instrumental in how the Arab world and how the Middle Eastern world transitioned from kingdoms, kings and queens, and the monarchy to a military rule with leaders that had prior military background instead of ancestral or political. And this is particularly interesting to me because it almost feels like he was the first of his kind, this creation of military dictator, and other countries after that followed suit. And I'll get into what countries in a second. But Nasser was an army, Egyptian army officer, the prime minister from 1954 to 1956, and then the president 56 until 70 when he died. He was a controversial leader of the Arab world, creating the very short-lived United Arab Republic from 1958 to 61, and he fought twice with Israel in the Arab-Israeli wars, one in 56 and one in 47. And he was also in the army for the 1948 First Arab-Israeli War. And as a teenager, I'm going to go back in time, and as a teenager, he was constantly in trouble with his school teachers. Some of them were British, and he took part in a lot of anti-British street demonstrations because he didn't want the occupation to continue. And in one fun fact, in one demonstration, he received a blow to his forehead that left him a lifelong scar on his face, if you look at photos of him. He went to a Royal Military Academy, and then he graduated as second lieutenant. And while he was serving in the Egyptian army in Sudan, Nasser met three fellow officers, Zakaria Mohaddin, who was later the president of the United Arab Republic, Abd al-Hakim Amir, who was the field marshal eventually, and then Anwar al-Sadat, who would succeed Nasser as president after he died.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
What area is the United Arab Republic?
I will get into that, but okay. Basically he wanted to unite the Arab world, and so he... Egypt, Syria, and then Libya were the main members of the Arab Republic because he wanted to unite the Arab world. And so these four men, they planned a secret revolutionary organization called the Free Officers, and their aim was to oust the British and Egyptian royal family, and he was kind of the leader of this. He was very respected for his military experience, and in the 1948 Arab War against the newly created State of Israel, he was an officer in one of the three battalions surrounded for weeks by Israelis in a group of Arab villages called the Fallujah Pocket. And so on July 23rd, 1952, Nasser and 89 other free officers, they staged an almost bloodless coup d'etat, and they ousted the monarchy. Sadat, one of these men that he met that created this organization with him, he favored the immediate execution publicly of King Farouk I and some of the members of his establishment. But Nasser vetoed the idea, and he permitted Farouk and the others in his company to go into exile instead. The country was taken over by a revolutionary command council of 11 officers controlled by Nasser, with Major General Mohammad Najib as the puppet head of state. So for more than a year, Nasser kept his real role so well hidden that even astute foreign correspondents were unaware of his existence. But in the spring of 1954, he emerged from the shadows and named himself the prime minister, and he deposed of Najib and placed him under house arrest. In that same year, an Egyptian fanatic tried to assassinate Nasser at a mass meeting in Alexandria. And the gunman confessed that he had been given this assignment by the Muslim Brotherhood, and after that... Nasser cracked down on this extremist religious organization, and even though Nasser himself was Muslim, the Muslim Brotherhood wanted a far stricter Muslim country because the one Nasser was molding was more liberal. And
what? They've been around for that long?
Mm-hmm. Yep. They've been Muslim and crazy for that long, giving us all a bad name. crackdown of the Muslim Brotherhood was kind of when I think the dictator in him started coming out, because this led to a lot of imprisonments of the alleged members of this organization and violent crackdowns that would stamp out any objection to his authority, because anything, any word against him was then deemed a crime or a threat to him. In 1956, he announced the creation of a constitution under which Egypt became a socialist Arab state with a one-party political system, with Islam as the official religion. And so in June of that year, 99.948% of the 5 million Egyptians voting marked their ballots for Nasser, the only candidate for president. Again, kind of a dictator thing to do. And the constitution was approved by 99.8%. So as he took this title, as well as the actual control of Egypt, the country's prospect looked pretty bright. He introduced far-reaching land reforms, and even though he overthrew the monarchy and the previous ruling establishment, he made an effort to preserve the history of Egypt, and he never demolished or destroyed any monuments or historical buildings. He was very, he preserved the history of the country. And his popularity in Egypt and the Arab world skyrocketed after his nationalization of the Suez Canal and his political victory in the subsequent Suez Crisis. And I'm going to get into that because it's a very important thing that happened that kind of changed everything. So a secret contract had been signed with Czechoslovakia for war material, and Great Britain and the United States had agreed to put up $270 million to finance the first stage of the Aswan High Dam project in Egypt. It was a dam for Egyptian water. But on July 20th, 1956, the U.S. Secretary of State at the time, John Foster Dulles, he canceled the U.S. offer, and the next day Britain followed suit. 5 days later, addressing a mass meeting in Alexandria, Nasser announced the nationalization of the Suez Canal, promising the tolls Egypt collected in the 5 years would build a dam. Both Britain and France had interest in the canal, and they conspired with Israel, surprise, surprise, whose relations with Egypt had grown even more tense after the first Arab-Israeli war in 48, and they wanted to best Nasser and regain control of the canal. And then, according to their plan, Israeli forces invaded the Sinai Peninsula in October of 1956, and then 2 days later, French and British planes attacked Egyptian airfields. And although the Israelis occupied a good portion of the Sinai Peninsula, and the Egyptian Air Force was virtually destroyed, Nasser emerged from this brief war with undiminished prestige throughout the Arab world, and it only garnered him more respect because he was known as someone who refused to back down.
Can I ask another question?
Yes, sorry.
Why did they want that canal so bad? Like, why did they want to control that canal? Was that water like...
It's on the border of Israel and Egypt, and I think they wanted it to just be theirs instead of Egypt's. You know, because it's like a port. And
like they wanted anyone, like Egypt and France, and not Egypt, England and France and Israel, to be able to like use it instead of just having it be Egypt's.
Because when Nasser would feel any hostility from Israel, he would stop trading with them from that port. So I think they just wanted like complete control over the trades. And historians, they conclude that this crisis signified the end of Great Britain's role as one of the world's major powers. And after this happened, the canal, the Suez Canal, was closed from October 56 to March 1957. And even though Israel fulfilled some of its objectives, like attaining the freedom of navigation through the Straits of Tehran, because Egypt had blocked those to Israel since 1950. But as a result of this conflict, the United Nations created the United Nations Emergency Force. And they put police peacekeepers in at the Israeli-Egyptian border, and the Prime Minister at the time of Britain, Anthony Eden, resigned. So, as I said earlier, Nasser called for a pan-Arab unity under his leadership, and this increased his popularity and how much everyone loved him. And even though it was short-lived, he created the United Arab Republic with Syria from 1958 to 1961, and I'll get more into why this was so important after a quick commercial break. And we're back. Okay. So the United Arab Republic, It was a monumental moment in the Arab world because you had a leader attempting to unite all of these separate Arab countries together again, and he wanted to make the Middle East stronger and formidable like it was in the past. And in 1962, he began a series of major socialist measures and modernization reforms in Egypt. He began his second presidential term in March 1965 after his political opponents were banned from running. Again, a sign of a dictator. But he was so well-loved.
I don't know. Maybe he was just the only guy that knew what he was doing.
I mean, there is that. And I think a lot of Arabs will ignore his flaws because he did a lot of good for the Arab world. Then another important event happened in 67 called the Six-Day War. The Six-Day War is also called the June War and the Third Arab-Israeli War, and it was a very brief war that was literally 6 days in June 1967 that occurred in Israel. And prior to the start of the war, attacks conducted in Israel against Israel by the fledgling Palestinian guerrilla groups in Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, these had increased, and in 1966, in November, an Israeli strike on the village of El Samu in the Jordanian West Bank left 18 dead and 54 wounded. And then Israel, after that, also in April, they shot down 6 Syrian fighter jets. After this happened, Nasser unanimously, or very publicly demonstrated support for Syria. And in May 14th, 1967, he mobilized Egyptian forces in the Sinai Peninsula. On May 18th, he requested the removal of the United Nations emergency forces that had been placed there after the Suez Canal crisis. So he removed that. And then on May 22nd, he closed the Gulf of Abaqa to Israeli shipping again because he was standing with Syria. And then this instituted the Fatah blockade of the port of Eilat in southern Israel. On May 30th, the King Hussein of Jordan arrived in Cairo to sign a mutual defense pact with Egypt, placing Jordanian forces under Egyptian command, and then shortly after that, Iraq joined the alliance. So at this point, the United Arab Republic was Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, basically.
Libya was out?
Oh, Libya was there, sorry.
But Jordan joined as well.
So yeah, Jordan basically, for this Six-Day War, they signed over their military to Nasser. They were like,
why did they kick out the United Nations?
Because it was supposed to be for peace. And they were like, we're gonna go to war for this. Yeah, that's basically. Cool. Yeah. It's like, fuck you. However, I wish this ended in a better way, but they underestimated Israel and the amount of support it had from the U.S., Israel had been doing strenuous military training, and this little juicy tidbit was for my mother, and I believe her, and I didn't even want to look it up because I don't want to find out that she's wrong, but she said that the United Arab Republic bought defective weapons from Italy, and Italy kind of, like, fucked them over, because these weapons literally backfired on the soldiers that were holding them. And in addition to Israel being very prepared and backed by the U.S. with much better weaponry, Israel destroyed the Egyptian Air Force, and the United Arab Republic ultimately suffered defeat. And this was a huge moment for the land that Israel swallowed up, because their victory in the Six-Day War included the capture of the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the Old City of Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights. And these territories subsequently became a major point of contention in the Arab-Israeli conflict. And Nasser was very defeated by this defeat, and he announced his resignation because he was very, like, ashamed.
Those smarmy Italians.
I didn't even want to look it up because I just wanted to believe the story. But my mom was 8 at the time that Nasser announced his resignation in 67, and she remembers everyone in Syria listening so intently to the radio as he announced this. And everyone was devastated. She said that her grandmother was sobbing. People were committing suicide because they were so sad that he was resigning. People were threatening to kill themselves. A lot of articles ran and news stories were begging him to come back. And because of this, and because of the Arab world showed him how much they liked him, he actually returned to the office after popular demonstrations for his reinstatement. So he didn't even officially resign for, like, more than a couple months.
Wait, you know what that reminds me of? That scene in Wolf of Wall Street? Yeah. When he's trying to resign, but everyone's like, no, come on, man! And then he's like, you're right!
It's more just like, like a trying to get validation. Like, yeah. You don't want me. It's like, yeah, we do. Yeah,
he's
we
like
do,
fishing
man.
For compliments. Yeah, yeah. That's crazy.
I know. So he was reinstated. He didn't resign. And in 1968, he had appointed himself prime minister, and he launched the War of Attrition to regain the lost territory and began a process of depoliticizing the military, and he issued a set of political liberalization reforms. After the conclusion of the 1970 Arab League summit, he unfortunately suffered a heart attack and he died. Hmm. His funeral in Cairo drew drew 5 million mourners and an outpouring of grief across the Arab world. And he still remains an iconic figure in the Arab world, particularly for his strides towards social justice and Arab unity, modernization policies, and anti-imperialist efforts. His presidency also encouraged and coincided with an Egyptian cultural boom, and he really put an effort in preserving Egyptian culture, and he made it this mecca of I don't know, antiquity in a way. And he launched large industrial projects, including the Aswan Dam and the Helwan City. His detractors, unfortunately, criticized his authoritarianism, his human rights violations, mm-hmm. and his dominance of military over civil institutions, establishing a pattern of military and dictator rule in Egypt, as well as other Arab countries. This pattern is also seen in Syria, with Hafez al-Assad, who was a military general that became the president after a military coup, in Iraq with Saddam Hussein, who was an Iraqi army general, and Libya, because Gaddafi was an army officer who led a coup in Libya and ended up overthrowing the monarchy and put himself in power. So because it started with Egypt, other Arab countries followed suit after that. But he was the first. Nasser was the first to do this. And the rise of Nasser foreshadowed a wave of revolutions throughout the Middle East in the 1950s and 60s, with the collapse of monarchies again in Egypt, Iraq, and Libya. He inspired nationalists throughout the Middle East by fighting the British and the French during the Suez Crisis of 1956, modernizing Egypt, and uniting the Arab world politically. And again, when I was in San Diego, my mother was telling me about how much my grandfather especially admired Nasser. And my grandfather on my mom's side, he's still alive. I'm very happy he is because he's the best. But he still holds him in the highest regard. And she remembers clearly how her family and other Syrians loved him as she was growing up, even though she was just a child. Again, her grandmother at the time literally sobbed when he announced resignation on the radio. And this was in Syria, not even in Egypt. Like, I can only imagine his love of the citizens of Egypt. But Arabs are very proud of him, and even my mother talked about him with a great sense of pride because of the good he did despite his other unfortunate shortcomings. But I thought it was a good thing to talk about just so people understand like how this trend happened or came about with military men taking power in the Middle East rather than politicians or even people that had like royal blood, you know. So that's my piece.
So a lot of his popularity came from the fact that he just like stood and like protected the Arabs basically
exactly.
and their land and culture and whatnot.
Exactly. Yeah. And he, I mean, I really respect him despite him being a dictator, literally. I respect that he wanted the Arab world to be united, you know?
Yeah.
Because we're so divided even now. And it would have been nice to like be a fucking empire.
I have a question. So when, and I have so many questions all the time. When did Hafez al-Assad take control after him?
Yeah, it was after. It was
okay,
in the 60s.
So technically for a while, like Syria was just under his control.
Technically Syria, it was occupied by the French for a while.
Oh.
And the French would put these like random people in power. And then there was a lot of military, like, or not military, I mean, he took power from a military coup, but I believe there were other military coups before him, but those people kept, like, dying because and being assassinated.
I see.
But, yeah, Syria had a lot of turmoil and, like, what's the word? Like,
just unsteadiness?
Yeah, unstable. Instability. Instability.
Unsteadiness.
But, yeah. But it's interesting because even if you, I looked up what his photo was and he's like, he was a man, like, there were, I guess you could interpret it as, like, being kind of, like, dictatory, because they did the same thing in Syria with, like, these giant photos of Bashar and Hafez, but in Egypt, he was truly loved. I think in Syria, there are photos of the Assads everywhere from fear, mostly, but in Egypt, it was out of love, and, I think he had good intentions. I think the dictator was brought out on him because the attempt on his life was so early, with the Muslim Brotherhood. Even though he was Muslim himself, I think it led him to make Islam the national religion of Egypt.
He kind of looks like an Arab Clark Gable.
Ooh. Yeah, so my mom...
That's Clark.
Yeah.
Well, look at him here.
Damn, yeah. Very strong chin.
Yeah.
Damn. Yeah. So he's like a... He's a G, you know? I mean, no one's perfect. I'm not saying I like him or dislike him, but I respect what he was trying to do in some regard.
That's tight.
Yeah. Thanks, Mom, for that idea.
He started the coup.
He made started the coup the trendy. Whole thing. Yeah.
The coup is so trendy now.
Yeah. I mean, Saudi Arabia is one of the few countries left that still has a kingdom.
I know this is probably not the right time to talk about this, but what if I like had a coup at House Stuff where I'm sure
our intern Jack is at this table right now.
What if I cooed Jack out of here? Just like, I don't know what I would do, but
it's a funny word. I like
a too. Podcast talent coup, mm-hmm. where we all just like, I don't know.
Put him into this exile.
Not thought out. Yeah. Yeah. Exile him from podcasting. He's over at Earwolf now. Okay.
Okay, so what are you going to talk about?
I'm actually going to, I'll do a little extension off of your Israel. I'm going to do my spin-off. Like,
yeah.
That you were doing, like, Cheers, and I'm about to do Frasier.
Okay, yeah. Are they spin-offs of each other?
Yes, Frasier's a spin-off of Cheers.
I had no idea.
Frasier was always in the Cheers bar, like, drinking himself to death or something. He wasn't really drinking himself
to death. The more you know.
First, you learned about the cigar.
I'm learning so much this episode.
You know, actually, I loved Cheers growing up.
You did.
Never cared for Frasier.
I never watched either of them.
Honey, you didn't miss out. Except for Cheers was pretty good.
I've heard Cheers is not bad, but, you know.
I mean, if you're looking for, like, a nice, like, Ted Danson, you know, like, Rhea Perlman, what's the crazy one?
Betty White?
No. Betty White was Goldie's. Goldie Girls.
My bad.
Christy Alley.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
A little mixture of, I don't know what I'm pitching here. Okay. So the other day, I wanna say, I don't really recall what day, maybe earlier this week, I saw a tweet from our boyfriend Reza Aslan.
Yes.
Our boyfriend. We're both dating him simultaneously.
I mean, yeah.
We're in a polygamous relationship with Reza.
It's the future,
Aslan.
Man. It's the future, okay?
He tweeted out his experience being detained and interrogated by Shin Bet, which is Israel's security service, kind of like they're not necessarily just border, but they're just like overall security. He tweeted it out, and then he, I'll read the tweets a little later, but he talked to Haaretz, I don't know how to say that, which is a... somewhat biased.
Yeah, it's I think it's very publication, biased publication.
Online publication, if you will. But so he talked to them and kind of explained what happened with his questioning at the Israeli-Jordanian border about like 2 or 3 weeks ago. And of course, in response to his claim, Shin Bet was like, no. And they said... that Aslan, who is American citizen. He was born in Iran, but he left when he was like three or something like that. They said the reason he was interrogated was because his behavior raised suspicions.
What the fuck?
Which literally could mean anything. Like he, you know.
Yeah.
And they denied threatening him or ever asking him about his political positions, which is like, okay, that's probably the first thing you would do. But anyway. So I'll break down what happened. He talked about it to Haaretz, like I said, and he tweeted about it. And, of course, that, like, picked up some attention in the Middle East regions. No one talks about it here.
No.
I, like, couldn't find a single, like, American, like, national whatever paper that wrote about it.
That's absurd.
Like, Haaretz was the best source I could find.
Wow.
Huh? I mean, they're the only ones that care, apparently. And it's because it could potentially make Israel look bad, probably. So
He said he'd visited Israel multiple times in the past, and he said, every time I visited Israel before, I was pulled aside, asked some security questions, or asked to open my suitcase. Once I was even strip-searched. But I always understood why it happened. Whether it's fair or not, the fact that I was born in Iran, that I'm Muslim, and that I usually travel alone, I get that Israel has some security concerns that this relates to. I fit a certain profile. I've never complained about this extra treatment in the past. I even wrote that this is actually somewhat justified. And that's interesting because I always thought that if you had an Iranian passport, mm-hmm. you can't go to Israel.
Oh.
I actually did some research because I was like, I'm pretty sure it's... I'm surprised he could even get in, but he doesn't
have...
Do you think
it's because he's American?
Well, he doesn't have dual citizenship with Iran anymore.
Oh.
Because he literally can't go back to
right,
Iran.
Right, you mentioned... Yeah, because you have to cancel it, basically.
Well, he's just been too, like,
Vocal
and, like, you know... Mm. Just talks a lot of shit about Iran, basically. The, you know, the regime. So he can't actually go back to Iran. I think he hasn't been back since, like, 2005.
Wow.
So, I mean, and also Iran can easily get rid of your citizenship. So, yeah. So now he's able to go because, you know, he's not, like, actively hanging out in Iran or hanging out with any Iranian politicians or regime members. Anyway, so he continues, said, but the interrogation I experienced 2 weeks ago was something different. This was clearly focused on my politics. Sorry. I've never had anything like it before in Israel. It was all about my political views, my articles, my activism. The women who interviewed me knew all about my op-eds and my history with CNN.
Holy shit.
So, like, that kind of implies that they have this kind of whole system where they're like, they know who is saying what. Goddamn. Because I, like, wanted to go. I wanted to go float in some salt water, but look at me now.
Oh, we're fucked. No, we're never
going.
Yeah.
I have no chance.
No, I have too much shit.
It's so pretty, though, if you Google image Israel.
Yeah, let's go on Birthright. Fuck Birthright.
We should go on Birthright. We can be on, like, some AJ
Plus
video.
I've talked about how much I hate Birthright, right?
But imagine, like, we're there, we're on the bus, and then we're like, no, and they're like, what? Like that video.
Yeah, that's a great video. I have all the respect.
We can be on like an online content aggregator being like, these two girls upset Birthright.
AJ We've Plus talked about that on this podcast,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just wanted to make sure people aren't understanding what we're talking about.
Yes. There was these people who were like, this feels like propaganda. And they were like, you will pay for your own flights back.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like, okay.
That's a good summary.
They're so intense. Anyway. So he goes on to explain that they asked him about his Trump or his views on Trump and Netanyahu, and like the fact that he didn't like Netanyahu was like a serious threat to them, which is like, okay, whatever. The guy is not exactly the most
likable man.
I'm sorry to say it, but he doesn't really draw love from the world. Anyway, so I'm going to read his thread. So 2 weeks ago, as I was crossing back from Israel. As I was crossing back into Israel from Jordan, I was separated from my family and detained by Shin Bet. We can make it so you don't see your kids for a long time, I was warned. This is what happened next.
What?
That's classic police state. Threaten the kids. You'll never see your kids again. Shireen, you'll never see your kids again.
My family.
Your family. So the Shin Bet lady, who already knew everything about me and my family's journey around the world, began with, you think because you're a public person, I can't do whatever I want with you? I was floored. This is how interrogations begin in police states. Why do you hate Israel? She asked. I don't hate Israel, I replied. But you hate our prime minister. I'm sorry, is your prime minister Israel? He's a smart one. He was democratically elected. No, he wasn't, but let's drop that. So was Trump, and I hate him and still love America. Oh, I know all about you and Trump, she spat.
What the fuck?
Oh, fucking
no. I like the voice that you're putting on for us.
Thank you. I'm kind of doing a play right
now.
I forgot the Israeli right wing's affection for our racist neo-Nazi loving president. Burn. Ooh. You don't think Israel should exist, yes? That's absurd. I'm against the occupation, not Israel. Then the police state part began in earnest. Now, this is where we have to take a quick commercial break. I will be back with this very riveting story.
You mean intermission?
Yes, this is intermission of my play, the Reza Aslan story in Israel. And when I come back, you'll find out what happens next. And we're back. So, as I was saying before, I was reading my stage play of what happened to Reza Aslan when he was interrogated by Shin Bet at the Israeli-Jordan border. I will continue now. So after they started asking him about if he likes Netanyahu and Trump and all that, this is when they really start to get into it. Write down names of Palestinians you know. Write down names of journalists you associate with. Write down the names of Palestinian organizations you support. And constantly, repeatedly, this threat. If you don't cooperate, it will be a long time before you see your kids again. What? I tried to cooperate the best I could. It was 104 degrees. My wife, my 2 6-year-olds, my 3-year-old, and I, and my 2 elderly in-laws had been waiting for me in the sun for hours. But, again, the police state tactic. Every answer I gave, she told me, was lie. Stop lying, she'd yell. That's crazy. The questions got dumber and more surreal. Who did your father work for in Iran? I don't know. I was 7 when we left. Oh, Mr. Scholar, you can tell me everything about the Ottoman Empire, but you don't know your own father's history? For the record, I am not an Ottoman scholar. Just like, what the fuck? In the end, after hours of this, she warned, I may let you into Israel, but who knows? I may not let you out. I will keep you here and kick out your family. It depends on you. You would miss your kids, yes? That, my friends, is the classic police state trick. Iran has perfected it. Her final warning was not to visit the Palestinian territories, not to meet with or speak to any Palestinians or any Israeli troublemakers. We are watching you. And then 2 days later, he went to Bethlehem and took a photo of the Ahed Tamimi mural that the Italian artists painted. Yeah, so he wrote, this was my 4th trip to Israel in 10 years, and every time it's gotten worse. It's becoming unrecognizable as a democracy. It is becoming a full-blown police state, and it can't last. When I was released, my evangelical in-laws were in shock. I had no idea it was like this, they said. Now they do. So do more Americans each day. And if Israel loses them, who will continue to shield it from pressure to change course? The clock is ticking. He wrote that in his tweet. The clock is ticking. So that's fucking crazy.
Yeah.
I don't.
This is someone like that's known. Imagine if it was just a normal fucking guy.
And that happens every day. Yeah. Normal fucking guys are being interrogated. So naturally, the Shin Bet denied the claim. They said, you know, Aslan was interrogated at the border crossing with Israel by the Shin Bet after his behavior raised suspicions. After he was shortly questioned, Aslan was released as suspicions were dispelled.
Wow.
Which is just like, okay. So Haaretz, which we figured out is more left-leaning bias, even though sometimes their op-eds, they got some weird op-ed writers. But I guess so does the New York Times, so who the fuck knows what these op-ed writers, motherfuckers. Looking at you, Bari Weiss.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say that.
Also, someone messaged me like, you know she's an editor, right? She's in charge of people. And that scared me. Yeah, so here's what went down. Basically, Reza Aslan went to Israel. He had no problems getting into the country. And then after a few days, they went to Jordan for like 2 or 3 days to visit Petra. And then when they came back, that's when he got stopped for questioning.
Interesting.
Yeah, the whole thing of, like, writing down what Palestinians
know,
it's like, you fucking sketchballs. Way to try and act like you're not, like, look at just an Arab person and be like, what you planning?
Exactly.
And it's like, what Palestinians, you know, like, I don't know, there's that one dude, like,
And they automatically assume that he thinks that he doesn't think Israel should exist. Like, they already are defensive just because you're Arab.
Yeah.
Or Middle Eastern, rather.
So what motivated Aslan to write about this interrogation was when Peter Beinart, who is like a pretty big Jewish American journalist, he writes for like The Atlantic and he's on CNN and I don't know, he's out there. He wrote this article that was published on The Forward, which was all in first person, because he was detained for questioning at the Ben-Gurion International Airport trying to enter Israel. And he was going there for a bat mitzvah for one of his nieces. And he got pulled aside and was interrogated about his, basically his politics, like where he stood. And he writes a lot about like Israeli-Palestinian conflict that is happening. He supports boycotting products manufactured in Israeli settlements in the West Bank. He was questioned about, like, a broad series of topics, but then they all kept coming back to, like, his political affiliations and his ties to groups in Israel that oppose settlements and the policies that, you know, the right-wing government is trying to push. Like, he writes a lot about not being for that. So according to Baynard, he and his family, they came to Israel to attend the bat mitzvah, and their passports were scanned, and then he was pulled aside, and he says, the session ended with my interrogator asking me point blank, if I was planning to attend another protest. I answered truthfully, no, and that's when I was sent back to the holding room. And then he called Gabby Lasky, who's the Israeli human rights attorney who was Ahed Tamimi's attorney. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then a few minutes later, after he called her, he was released and allowed to enter the country. And then he described the ordeal as a Jewish experience for his children to remember. He added, he didn't feel scared or victimized, but that the whole conversation was really depressing. And then he also said that his interrogator established no consistent or objective standard for my detention. His standard was whether I planned to cause trouble, trouble meaning whatever he and his superiors wanted it to mean. Mm-hmm. So, of course, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he heard about this and then he responded to the tension. He put out a statement and it said, heard of Mr. Baynard's questioning at Ben Gurion Airport and immediately spoke with Israeli security forces to inquire how this happened. He was told it was an administrative mistake. Israel is an open society which welcomes all, critics and supporters alike.
Yeah,
Israel
right.
is the only country in the Middle East where people voice their opinions freely and robustly.
They banned Al Jazeera!
How crazy is that?
Fuck! That's the biggest lie I've ever heard.
That's almost like a very legendary statement to me. Like, yeah, we're out here. Like, people are very free here.
That's okay. The biggest lie.
I wish I could say like really crazy shit like
the
that.
The nerve of someone to say that. It's absurd.
So Baynard's interrogation is the latest in a lot of like basically people coming through the border and getting held for mm-hmm. political questioning. And a lot of them are American Jewish people. So last month, Jewish American philanthropist who donated millions to Israeli hospitals and schools was interrogated because security at Ben Gurion found a booklet about Palestine in his suitcase, which is like,
what?
Okay. And then about 2 or 3 weeks ago, two left-wing Jewish American activists, Simone Zimmerman and Abigail Kirschbaum. Okay. they, say it right. They were detained for 3 hours at the border crossing between Israel and Egypt. It's Simone Zimmerman. She is one of the founding members of the Jewish Anti-Occupation, If Not Now. She said she was interrogated about her political opinions. And then activist Abigail Kirschbaum was also questioned. And then Israel, the Shin Bet were like, oh, no, it was not recommended that she be questioned. But we just kind of wanted to, like, we just wanted to question them. It's like, it doesn't make any sense. They were like, we didn't recommend she be questioned. She just kind of got questioned.
Right.
It's like, okay.
It's a random selection.
Yeah. So Baynard actually mentioned Zimmerman's attention in his article, and he describes Zimmerman's questioning as, in quotes, an overall trend in Israel. The day before Netanyahu all but incited violence against the new Israel's Fund director in Israel, the next day.
Mm-hmm.
That was a confusing statement, but I'm just saying he basically went after her the day before
right.
and then was questioned the next day. Mm-hmm. And then they were like, no.
Yeah. How cool. It's a coincidence.
Doesn't make any sense. And he also said, Baynard also said, the Israeli government's passage of the contentious nation state law as part of a process in which, in his view, allows Israel to get uglier. And that's the whole, you talked about this last time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where they passed a law that made, what was it that, it's a...
It made it illegal to talk badly about Israel, that you're saying?
Yeah, also, didn't they
and,
also...
And they made Arabic, like, they made Hebrew their official language.
Yeah, they made it like the official.
Yeah, it's officially a Jewish state
yes.
that is
doesn't recognize the Arab
exactly.
religion in any way.
Yeah.
Arab ethnicity or
no.
religion that they follow,
yeah.
Islam or whatever.
It's just they're second class citizens officially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not crazy. You're crazy. Okay. So real quick. So is the Israel director at J Street, Yael Petir, she responded to Baynard's attention on Monday, saying that a slippery slope has turned into a dark and dangerous abyss when every citizen who dares criticize the Netanyahu government can find himself interrogated over his opinions. The clerks of the Immigration Authority and Shin Bet interrogators become, against their will, the obeyers of a regime that uses them as a tool for political persecutions. And then she also continued, if the government of Israel wants some sort of connection to the vast majority of U.S. Jewry, as well as to preserve the Israeli democracy, the political interrogations ought to stop entirely. I mean,
that's a dictatorship.
Yeah. So,
I mean, at least it's like, at least it's these people. I'm glad that people are with platforms are talking about their experience, because I can only imagine what, again, like, a citizen goes through, like the extreme amounts that they interrogate, and yeah,
it's wild.
Yeah.
Shin Bet commented on Baynard's arrest, and they said Mr. Baynard's attention was carried out as a result of an error of judgment by the professional official at the scene. Whatchamacallit? Sorry, we are sorry for the unpleasantness Mr. Baynard experienced. The Shin Bet chief has instructed that the case be looked into. Which is like, yeah, I bet. And then Peter Baynard responded to Netanyahu's apology, and he said, Benjamin Netanyahu has half apologized for my detention yesterday at Ben Gurion Airport. I'll accept when he apologizes to all the Palestinians and Palestinian Americans who every day endure far worse.
It's a great fucking statement.
Yeah, so that's what's going on at the airport. So honestly, if you have been critical against Israel in the past and you do plan to visit Israel, I just think, you know, be careful, be safe out there. You might get pulled aside. Just answer their questions. Don't try and act a fool. Yeah.
Don't go if you have children.
Yeah, God. Do you want to see your children ever again?
What if he was like, no?
No, please put me away for good. They
drive me crazy.
It's very wild.
I'm glad you talked about that, because it's so important. And as you said, no American news outlet is really talking about it. Like, very few articles have come out.
And no one holds our boyfriend.
Yeah.
Aslan. I hope he hears this and files like restraining orders against him.
Well, okay. our listeners that are only like podcast listeners might not know this, but when we had a YouTube show, Reza Aslan tweeted out that he liked it. So there's a relationship there.
He's our boyfriend.
Yeah. We have approval from Reza.
And if you don't know who Reza Aslan is, that's hurtful. He's our boyfriend. You should Google him. He's an Iranian-American writer, journalist, Showtime man.
Yeah. He's great. He does have a show.
He did have a show called Believer that got canceled because he tweeted like that Trump sucked, basically, and they took his show away. But Trump can say whatever he wants, and he can do whatever he wants.
Oh, yeah.
No big deal.
Are you ready for our last little segment?
Yes.
So I am going to call my mom, and here we go. Do I put it on speaker? Is it? Oh,
no, it just goes through.
Shoo shoo.
Mommy!
Shoo shoo. Mommy!
Hi, Mama.
Hi, Hayati.
Hayati.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Alhamdulillah, Mama.
You're on our podcast.
Alhamdulillah. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. We should have you sometime. Come over and I'll cook for you.
I would love that.
Yeah.
I'll eat everything.
I'll feed you Syrian food.
I'll eat everything.
She's the best. My mom makes the best food.
I believe that.
So last week we called... Hello? Can you hear me?
No, I can hear you.
Oh, okay. So last week we called Anna's mom, and this week we're calling me, my mom. No, we're not calling me. We're calling my mom. Why do I have a podcast? Because we've called you in a very, very early episode before.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. And so I want to ask you some questions and talk about some stuff that I haven't asked you yet.
Shoot.
Okay. So Tell me about your job in Syria, and because you were an English teacher, right?
Yes, yes.
So you did you feel like you were very, before you moved here, did you feel like you were comfortable with the English language?
With the English language? We had like 4 years of English literature. Mm-hmm. So really what we learned is literature, mm-hmm. is American literature, right. English literature, not really how to speak, not right. how to make a conversation. So that's why when, so I can teach grammar and I mm-hmm. can teach, writing and essays and, how to, the spell and stuff, but I don't know how to speak. So when I came here, to listen to like American people talk, it was so weird for me. It's like they talking with food in their mouth, like they have an yeah. apple in their mouth. And I didn't understand the word they say.
Can you tell me about what happened when you were working at Baba's gas station?
I wasn't working.
Oh, you weren't working?
Your dad was working.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, your dad was working at the gas station. And I go there just because I was, I don't want to spend home. I was lonely. I had nobody. I didn't know a soul mm-hmm. in the United States. So I would drop him in the morning, at the gas station, take the car, go do shopping and mm-hmm. stuff. And sometimes in the evening, what should I do? I just go by, his station and spend some time and help him. Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to like help him. And he was like doing the gas stuff, selling gas. And this guy came to buy some snacks from the snack shop we had. Mm-hmm. And that was maybe my first customer or second customer. And he said something like, mo, mo, mo. And I was like, what? And he was saying Marlboro uh-huh. in a box.
Yeah.
So there's a soft and a hard box for Marlboro. Mm-hmm. And the way he said it, I don't know what Marlboro is. I know Marlboro.
Yeah.
Because back home, we call it Marlboro. So I thought that's the brand name, Marlboro. Right. But this guy would say Marlboro box. And I said, what he's saying? I don't understand. And I turned around to, to my husband, like, help, please. And, Salim just grabbed the Marlboro box and he just gave it to him and stuff. And the guy was like, he's shaking his head like, this immigrant,
Wow.
And I felt so bad. And after he left, I cried.
Oh, no.
Because I was like, where's my English? But it has nothing to do with English language. It's just like that, the accent, the heavy accent. Mm-hmm. And maybe this guy was like really, really, we used to be in Corona in the country. Mm-hmm. And this guy is just like, this cowboy country farmer, somebody like that. So he had this heavy accent I could not understand. Now I look back at it and I was like, oh my God, I was so stupid.
Mama, you weren't stupid. You had just moved here. Give yourself a break.
It was my second week in the United States. Yeah, I admit it.
Yeah. When you were growing up in Syria, did you imagine yourself coming here?
To the United States?
Yeah, because I know you've told me that you love literature. You love English.
Yeah.
Did you like English music or English movies?
All my life, mm-hmm. all my life. Like growing up, I grew up on Elton John's music, uh-huh. and Neil Diamond was my favorite, mm-hmm. And back then I was like a little child, like I was in elementary and middle school, mm-hmm. when I would look for Neil Diamond everywhere in the market if I find a CD, and it's very, not CD, the tape,
the cassettes.
The cassettes, and most of the time I can't find them, so I would ask people who is traveling abroad to bring me Neil Diamond cassettes or something. So I had a feeling since childhood, because I love to read, and I read a lot of books, literature, actually, just like novels and stuff like that, like Charles Dickens and Mark Twain and people mm-hmm. like that. So I always felt like I don't belong there in Syria. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the sense of belonging. And I felt like one day I'm going to go there. There where, like, maybe I was thinking maybe Europe or England, mm-hmm. you know, old England, British England. That's what I saw myself. But the United States, never.
Wow.
Never I thought I'm coming to the United States. Maybe, as I said, you know, somewhere in Scotland, in a cottage. Mm-hmm. I would live in a cottage in Scotland. That's it. Yep.
Yeah. Well, how did you react when Baba suggested that you move here then?
I didn't like it. In the beginning, I didn't like it because it was for me all of a sudden, mm-hmm. very sudden. We just get married 3 months before. We married in June, and June, July, August. And in September, he came to me and he said, I'm leaving. Not like what you think. What do you think if I go to the United States of America, I'm going to go and look what's going there? Nope. I'm leaving to America. We call it America, not the United States.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I said, why? And he said, well, I want to go. And he, you know, I had some stories, you know, the old podcast, remember when Daddy talked?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know few of the story, not the whole story, because he wouldn't tell me. It, you know, he want to provide me with this comfortable life. He doesn't want to bother me with what's going on, you know, in his job or
yeah.
the government and stuff. So he was like, I was sheltered, like, in these 3 months. And then he said, I'm going. And I said, okay. So I was like, he said, what? I said, okay. And my husband,
like,
my
okay,
father.
Okay, like, go. I'm going with you?
No, okay, go. No, oh. He has to go first.
Yeah, yeah.
See how it is. And if he likes it, if he can find a job, he will send for me.
Right.
Right? So I said, okay. And we had like a nice house, beautiful home, actually, that he built, you know.
Right.
And we chose like the paint and the furniture, mm-hmm. all designed furniture from Italy and stuff like that. And we had like very comfortable life here for 3 months. And then I told my parents, my family, my whole family, like, he's leaving. And he's crazy. He's losing it. His future is here. You know, he has everything every young man dream of doing in Syria.
Right.
A great job, a home, a car, which is like a car back home is a very luxury thing to have. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we live in a city. It's like a downtown, you know, L.A. You don't need, not
right.
L.A., downtown New York.
Right.
Because you don't need cars. You can like just use the public transportation, taxis mm-hmm. everywhere and stuff. And I said, yeah, he's going to go. So my dad took my husband aside. We had like a balcony at Damascus house, my parents' home. And he want to talk to my husband. So he sat down with him and he said, my son, you are doing a big mistake.
Oh.
Your future is here in this country. What you're doing is, I don't recommend, like, we are totally against it.
Wow.
Yeah, but it's your decision, it's your life, it just, this is how I see it as an old man, you know, and stuff. Him, Salim, you know, as he's always like, he's respectful to my dad. He said, thank you, appreciate it, but I want to go and check it. If I don't go now, I would regret it all my life. Like,
yeah.
I didn't go and now I'm stuck here. And that was my opinion. I said, if I said no and he didn't go, he would blame me for the rest of his life. Like, you prevent me from going,
right.
you know, and leaving. And he left. He left in September. And we didn't have phone calls like now. You know, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have even phone calls overseas.
Mm-hmm.
In order for my husband to call me overseas, he has to ask the operator. He would call the operator. You dial like 00. And the operator will come and he would say, I would like to put an overseas call to Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And he would give her the number he's calling. And 8 hours later, 4 hours later, 6 hours later, she would call and she said, you are connected overseas.
Wow.
And it was really expensive. Like the first minute, it's $8. Oh. Second minute is like $6 a minute. It was like a lot of money to make a call. So phone calls were very, little between us. But we would write. We would write like every week he would write me. And I would write, take 10 days to get the letter to me and 10 days to get my letter to him. So we spent the 5 months, like from September till February, just like talking sometimes and writing letters. And in February, he said, I found a place for us and I have this job. We bought like a small gas station and please come. Try to come. Then visa is impossible, you know, to get a visa to go to the U.S. So I went and tried and I got the visa.
Wow.
I was very, very lucky. Very lucky from like thousands of people, you know, just a couple of them that day got approved. One of them was me and another old guy. And it wasn't that hard like now. Now it's impossible to come, of course, especially after Trump. But even back then, this I'm talking about 33 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, I came here in 1986, 87. Salim came in 86 and I came in 87, February 87. Yeah.
That's crazy. I remember seeing those letters in the house.
We still have them. Yeah, I still have them.
Yeah.
Yeah, have them.
So it only took about less than a year for you to get out there.
Both of us, yes. Yeah, less than a year. Yeah, he left in September. I followed him in February. And life was very, very tough when I came to the state. Yeah. Really tough. But I enjoyed every day, every struggle. I'm not being like trying to be corny or anything. It's really, really like when I looked at my pictures when we just came, you can see from the eyes, you can see the smile, the laugh we had. We didn't care if we were poor, you know, we lost everything we had, you know, because you have to start from nothing from here. I came to one bedroom apartment. I had like a fancy home over there. One bedroom apartment, no furniture whatsoever. He just bought me a mattress, like a box and a mattress on the floor, on the carpet. You know, and that's it.
Wow.
We sat on the floor and his friend has like a broken TV. He gave it to us and we put like, fruit baskets. Like when you buy fruit from the market, like from the farmer markets, those plastic, what they call them? Like
cartons?
Like a carton, but it's a plastic. So we put two on the top of each other, upside down, and we put the TV on. And we stayed like this, I think, like for 6 months. And I was so happy. Because, you know, we married out of love. We didn't marry like because I had to marry him or anything. We fell in love and we were very happy together, Yamri.
Oh. do you have any questions for her?
How is your experience now? Shireen's father told us that he would send the man that you were originally with on long trips out of town so he could get him away from you. How long did it take you to realize that he was up to some tricks?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Never.
Really? Are you serious, Mama?
I don't know. I know I'm a smart person, you know.
You're very smart.
Yeah, I know. But
I guess you're oblivious. I think you're oblivious.
Just when it came to your dad. You know, I know a guy when he's like show interest in me, I would notice. Every woman would notice.
Yeah.
You know, but when it came to your father, I was so oblivious. Yeah, that's what you said.
So he showed his interest in a very peculiar way.
He didn't. I didn't think he was showing me interest. I just saw disgust with the other guy.
Right.
Mm.
But I didn't even occur to me like he would be interested in me, because I understood from, you know, I came in, you, everybody know him, mm-hmm. know his family, know everything. They told me he's from this neighborhood. It's called El Midan. El Midan is a very traditional, like the heart of Damascus, you yeah. know. Mm. It's very traditional, very religious, committed people, simple, honest people. So religious, you know, this mm-hmm. is the word, religious. And I'm not religious whatsoever.
Yeah.
So when they told me this, I had this idea about him, like he is just like his family.
Right.
So if he has religious family and his family like cover their head and hair and stuff all over, and I'm like this glamorous looking girl with like short miniskirt and, you know, and
your hair is
done
down,
and high heel.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would never, I didn't think like he would be interested in a girl like me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it was out of my perspective.
Right.
You know? That's why I didn't think of it.
Yeah.
Even when he like sent the guy all over, and the guy one time, his car turned all over. You know, he has a terrible accident. He almost died.
Oh my
died.
God! What?
He almost died. I swear he almost killed him.
Oh no. Holy shit.
Wow.
Oh my God, that's dark.
He went to great lengths to get
yeah.
him.
Wait, did Baba admit that he was doing this to you?
No, I didn't know it. He's doing it.
But after, even like when you guys were interested, like became engaged or whatever, did he admit that he had done that? Like, how did you figure it out?
Yeah. When he was admitting to me, like he was interested in me the first minute he saw me, the first second he saw
right.
me. When they introduced him to me, you know, come, we're going to introduce you to this new girl, new employee. And he saw me. He said, like, I was interested back then. I said, wow. And then he would tell me, like, do you know all these trips?
Oh
so
my
and
God.
So used to go. I don't want to name him. And I said, yeah.
My
and
dad
said,
hates his name.
Oh. And I said, yeah. So what about it? He said, I would send him on these trips. I said, oh, my God. You almost killed the guy.
Wow. That's some gaslighting.
Yeah. Wow. That's great.
Yeah, that's amazing. I have a couple more questions before we go. But so you never knew how to drive in Syria, right?
See, I took like not the driving lessons. Like my brother one time. No, I had like two brothers. One time I went with my you know they would took me around like like in a spin or something around the neighborhood to, it taught me how to drive, but I wasn't like I didn't drive really drive no
yeah also just so people know, how many siblings do you have? You have eight.
Yeah, I have eight. Yeah, we are nine kids.
That's amazing. That's incredible.
All natural delivery.
Wow.
Yeah.
Unlike me, same mother.
And my mom, one mother, and my mom is a full-time employee.
Teacher.
All her life, she was a teacher, then a principal for high school and middle school.
Wow.
So she was a full-time job, and she has activity after school. Like they would like what they call them, like for to help women learn how to like make a career for themselves.
Oh,
these
wow.
uneducated women stuff. She had full like a productive
full
life.
Schedule.
Yeah. Nine of us, but she wow. had help. She had help.
Well, you were the oldest. You were the oldest girl too. So you said that you raised some of your brothers and stuff.
I helped because we had two nannies at home. Mm. We had my grandmother who took care of us, my father's mother,
mm-hmm.
right? Grandma, you don't know this one.
No.
And my dad's aunt, who wasn't married, and Mame, who wasn't married. You don't know her.
Oh.
She died when I was in middle school, I think, or elementary. So there's two women at home helping my mom, or my mom could not do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she can't do it. That's why she had like nine kids, I think.
Wow.
I don't know.
Okay, we have to go pretty soon, but I wanted to. So Baba taught you how to drive in the U.S., right?
Yes, he did.
He taught all of us to drive, actually.
Yes, except Lulu, I did.
Oh, that's
Lulu,
true.
Lulu taught you to drive.
This is maybe a longer conversation for another time, but very briefly, you covered your hair and then uncovered your hair.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain just a little bit, like, why you did that?
In a short...
Yeah.
It's a long story, but I'll try to,
I mean, just,
to make it
just,
short.
Just how did you feel? How did it make
so
you
when
feel?
When I came to this country, mm-hmm. I told you I wasn't religious at all. I, you know, very glamorous and all this. I came and I felt very lonely.
Mm-hmm.
I had tons of friends, you know, relatives, nobody, you know, my sister. I was very close to my sister. And still I am, you know. Khalid Durain.
Yeah.
And I came and I had nobody. I was very, very lonely. But I had you. You know, I had Remy right away. Then I had you. And we would go to the library and go do swimming lessons and ballet. Mm-hmm. And I was just busy with my life, you know, just you. And I didn't have any friends whatsoever. And these people, they saw me in the library, I think. These two women. Covered and, you know, and they say, you know, is the Islamic hi, which is Salaamu Alaikum. And I answer back because they heard us speak Arabic with you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, where are you from? Blah, blah, blah. They introduced themselves and they said, why don't you come? You know, we have like a gathering every week. We mm-hmm. gather. And,
like a Quran study. And
just like a Quran study. And I said, no, I'm not interested. And... they took my phone number, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they kept calling me. They want me to come. And my husband said, look, go, you know, you're not going to, you know, go where the girls at their kindergarten or something. You just go to this gathering to see if you like it or not. So when you go, I went and I start going there. Like, they make you feel like you belong there,
mm-hmm.
like you are a family. You know, you're, you know the, how they, like... It's like I will really believe now it's a cult. Now I looking back at it, no, now it's a cult. Like they look for these vulnerable women, lonely women, who just like by themselves, just alone, looking for acceptance, looking belonging.
Yeah.
They make you feel you're the queen of the gathering. You're the princess. They shower you with like phone calls and gifts and just like. It's a good feeling. Like, finally, I have friends. I have people who loves me, who care for me, and stuff like that. And after a while, you know, you want to just belong to it there, you know. And they would start telling me, you know, you have to cover your hair. And I said, no way. And then you want to belong. Like, there's always part in the human heart, like, you want to belong to this group.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful group. I loved each one of them. And I said, okay, if that's, you know, what's, they said it's God's order and it's in the Quran and stuff like that. I said, okay, let's do it. So they made me cover. They put the scarf on me and I used to wear something, you remember,
yeah.
like a hat, you know, just tight in the back and not very like obvious scarf. And after you do it, they forget about you. And they move to the next target.
Wow.
But it's not like all of a sudden, like gradually.
Yeah.
Gradually. Like they are less interested. They don't call like before. And you look back and you see, wow, you know, when you are out of the group now. I said, you know, then you think about it. Like, why did I do that?
Wow.
You explain it to yourself. And that's the short of it.
If I know anything about you, you are very glamorous and you take good care of yourself and your hair. You have very beautiful hair. And so
thank you.
When you uncovered eventually, when you decided that wasn't for you, I feel like you regained some of your old self.
All the time I was covered, and I covered for a long time, like for 11 years.
Yeah.
Every time I looked in the mirror, I was looking at somebody I don't know.
Right.
Wow.
The woman in the mirror looking back at me with the hat, you know, mm-hmm. tied in the back, it wasn't me. There's something missing in me. I became shy. I became less social. Mm-hmm. I hated to go to the stores. I hated to go to the mall. I hated to walk outside. I would buy the treadmill so I can exercise at home, although I hated it.
Right.
I hate the routine. You know how much I love to walk outside, yeah, and the hike and the nature. All this was canceled from my life because I felt less confidence, because it wasn't me. It mm-hmm. wasn't, you know, it's like I'm ashamed of this woman.
Right.
Because she cannot, like, face the world and say, this is not me. And then before it had, like, I was, like, on the border of depression, I believe. Mm-hmm. I hit that thing. But I wasn't depressed. I was just stressed about it. And I talked to my husband. My husband is my rock, really. The first person I came to is Salim. One day, I think, I don't know, at night or in the morning, I said, Salim, what's your reaction will be if I told you I'm going to uncover my hair? And he said, why do you think about uncovering? And I said, yes. And he said, okay, so what you're thinking? Why you're hesitant? And I said, because I'm afraid what the people are going to say about me. Because in our community, there's a lady who used to cover and then she uncovered. And the community, the people who are like conservatives, talk a lot of bad stuff about wow. this woman. And I said, oh my God, if I uncover, that's what's going to happen to me. They're going to talk, you know,
yeah,
bad stuff about me. And I don't want to say a bad word. So my husband said, Salim said, If you think, you know, you're not doing anything wrong and you're not making God angry at you, who cares about people? And I said, what about your family? Because his family is the religious one, not right. my family. And he said, don't worry about my family. I will deal with them and you deal with your own. You deal with your own issue and I would deal with my family. Don't worry about it. If that's how you're comfortable with, just do whatever you're comfortable with. So I'm telling you, he's my rock, you know, he's mm-hmm. he's the one who gave me that final push, like, finally, this is me. And when in the beginning, when I took it off and I want to go out, I felt like I'm naked. Really, like, wow, you know, like maybe the first 2 days. And then,
can you tell me how old you were? Is that okay?
Wait, how old I was when?
When you uncovered.
That was 11 years ago, 12 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, I covered for 11, and I've been uncovered for 11.
I think it's so amazing to be, like, in the middle of your life and kind of rebirth yourself in a way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I covered when you were like, I don't know if you remember.
I remember you when you worked at my school as and when you were a lunch lady, you were covered. When you would give me free cookies and fries.
In Benesquitos, yeah, in Benesquitos, I think. Yes, I remember. Yeah.
But I just wanted to bring that up because I think a lot of people just assume when they see a woman covering her hair that, like, oh, her husband is oppressing her. But really, it's not. It's the woman's choice.
No, and, when I covered, my husband was the last one to know. I didn't even ask him. I didn't even consult him.
Yeah. Well, thank you for talking to me. I wish we could talk forever and ever and ever.
Yes, thank you for telling us all that.
It's so important. Welcome. Like, I know you think it's weird that we call you on this podcast, but I think it's very important to get the information from the source, you know? And I would rather you tell me your story than me try to tell it for you, because it's so incredible. And even, I mean, like, I can't get into this now, but you've talked about how praying 5 times a day was like meditation, and mm-hmm. how you used it as like just a way to be with yourself. And I think the way you think about the world and religion is so amazing and beautiful, and I just want everyone to know that. So thank you for talking to me and Anna.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, I love you, Mama.
I love you more, Yamri. I love you more, Yelvi.
Okay.
Invite Anna over. Tell her to come and I will cook Syrian food for her.
Yeah, okay. Come over, Anna.
I'll be there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye. I'm already in the car.
Bye.
Bye, Mama. I love you.
Bye.
Bye, girls.
Bye.
Bye,
Habib.
Bye.
Bye, Amri. Okay.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. Sorry that went really long.
Oh, I was deep in it. I was just listening.
But my mom is the fucking best. I'm so glad she was worried she was going to be shy. But
that's
crazy.
She got like inducted into this weird like Muslim group that just wanted to like change women. That's scary.
I've never heard her admit that it was a cult before. So that was interesting.
That's creepy. Yeah.
But if you see any photos of my mom when she was younger, even now, she is so beautiful and confident and like very outgoing. And I'm so proud of her for deciding for herself to uncover again, because she's just so magnetic and beautiful. And I'm not saying the hijab is a bad thing, but I'm saying it's each person's own preference.
Yeah,
and for her,
choice.
Yeah, and for her, she felt stifled or whatever. So, she inspires me a lot, and I'm glad she told that story. I think it's a very important story to know.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Like, those are, like, she was going through it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And that, when you're a kid, you don't know that. Like, I remember I was really, I regret this forever, but I saw a photo of my mom, because she used to wear a hat or even a bandana around her head to cover her hair. And I saw a photo of my mom a couple years ago with her wearing the bandana, and I was like, I can't believe that was you, like, making a joke.
Yeah.
And she got so, like, she was like, don't make fun of me. Like, that was a very hard time in my life. And I was like, well, first of all, I'm a cunt. Yeah. And second of all, it made me question, it made me really understand that she did it because she was so lonely.
Yeah.
And it was a time in her life that she did not feel like herself, like she said, like she didn't recognize herself. And so I've just appreciated her and her struggle so much. And as a kid, you don't see that. As a kid, you just see your mom covering her hair, and like, she's like weird, just like me, people treat her differently.
Yeah.
But like, again, like, she covered her hair when I was in middle school and she was a lunch lady, and like all my friends knew where she was because she covered her hair.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a lunch lady that would give out free cookies to my friends. But yeah, it's so important to think about that when you, I don't know, her story is important, and I'm sure it's similar to a lot of other stories as well, which is why it's important. So
it's also interesting that it's not always like internal pressure from like the community.
Yeah,
that was her scenario, but like, people all choose what they need.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah,
the cult, man.
I love my mom. She's just a special person. Oh, I didn't even... I wanted to tell her that I was wearing the pants we got together in New York. God. Well, if you're listening to this, Mama, I'm wearing the pants that we bought together. She bought the exact same pants. I'm wearing the pants.
That sounds like a personal call you can make. What can we do?
Well, thank you for hanging around if you've listened to this far. It was a long one, but thanks.
What do we do?
We are on Instagram.
Yes.
@ethnicallyambig.
Ambig.
@ethnicallyambig. On Twitter, we're @ethnicallyamb.
Mm-hmm.
We're on Facebook, if you look it up, Ethnically Ambiguous. You can go to Ethnically Ambiguous Pod to look at all our footnotes. And also, go to our Tee Public shop for merch. Merch.
Yeah, it's like tpublic/ethnicallyambiguous. Or you can go to tpublic and search ethnically ambiguous. Or you can Google the words tpublic and ethnically ambiguous. It pops up.
Yeah, it's in our Instagram bio and our Twitter bio as well.
Yes, and you can go to our website, ethnicallyambiguouspod.com. We are now putting our footnotes in the actual description of each episode, so it'll pop up on your platform that you're listening to, whatever, like Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, all that crap.
It's way more convenient.
Yeah, so you can like click.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who even really? I'm sure you don't read our footnotes. I'm sure you just believe everything we say.
Yeah, you should believe everything we say. Yeah, well, it is interesting. Until next time, Anna.
Is there anything else we have to do? No, we hit everything, right?
I think. Right.
I have a 3-second memory. You gonna bite that ass?
I bite that ass.